You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic, yeah. It's atomic.
This is Atomic Show number 63. And this is Rod Adams coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland. And I have a guest with me tonight who's actually going to turn the tables on us tonight and be the show host. And he's going to interview a special guest, Rod Adams. My guest tonight is...
And you can Nadir. Nadir.
Okay.
Also known as Dave Jones. That's my real name, so we can get through with that. And tonight I'm going to interview you, Rod, about the Adams Atomic Engine. And you're going to enlighten me about some of the things that I actually don't know, because my orientation has always been from a chemical perspective with nuclear technology. And as a result, I've been very much interested in chemical separations and recycling of fuels and what have you, that nature. And this is tend to keep me away a little bit from the idea of gas-cooled reactors, and I think the Adams Atomic Engine, from what I understand, is in fact a gas-cooled reactor using a stable form of fuel that's known as the TRISO fuel.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes. Let's put it, the Adams Atomic Engine doesn't really care that much about what the heat source is, as long as it is a zero-emission heat source that can get me to about 900 or 950 degrees Celsius turbine injection temperature. And at my review of the technology that's available today, the high-temperature gas reactors using TRISO-coated fuel particles, generally in the form of spherical fuel elements, I think is the best choice available. I've had a few people recently who've tried to tell me that they could do the same with molten salt reactors, and I'm listening and learning more about those.
Okay, yeah. So your focus here so far has been with what people like to call the pebble bed type technology. Am I correct in that? In that much of a
yes, yeah. The pebble bed type technology, although I try to remind people that the PBMR is a brand name for the pebble bed modular reactor, and that's not an Adams engine.
Okay, because that was going to be a question I was going to ask you. How does your reactor differ from the pebble bed reactor? And I guess really you have no real attachment to pebble bed. What you're really interested in, I guess, is the cycle that turns the turbines. Am I correct in that?
Well, what I started focusing on when I started developing the Adams engine concept almost 20 years ago now, is my first paper that I wrote on this topic was in 1991. But what I wanted to do was to try to figure out how to overcome what were the perceived disadvantages of nuclear technology. I had just come off an engineer tour on a U.S. nuclear submarine, so I had a pretty good idea what the limitations of pressurized water reactors with steam plant secondaries were. And I also had a pretty strong understanding that most of the disadvantages had really nothing to do with the nuclear part of that system. They were far more about the heat engine part. That was where my people spent most of their time in repair work, and where much of the cost of operations was in the secondary side, not the primary side.
So here we're talking about the steam generators and the turbines themselves and that sort of material.
Right. Well, if anybody's ever seen a cross-section of a submarine, and of course nobody's got any real details, but there are some pretty decent models out there that show where the reactor is and where the engine room is. And you can see just from that cross-section how small the reactor is and how large the engine room is, the part that actually converts the heat into motive energy. And, of course, on a submarine, that's propulsion energy. In a power plant, that would be electrical energy. But the same thing can be seen if you go to, say, the General Electric website or Westinghouse and see kind of a model of what a pressurized water reactor looks like. If you really try to isolate where the reactor is, you realize that there's an awful lot there besides that nuclear component. There's all the piping and valves and steam generators and everything that turn it into useful energy.
Right. So these engines are running on what we call their standard steam-type turbine engines, I guess what you're calling the Rankine cycle. And my understanding is that you're working off of a Brayton cycle. Is that correct?
That's true. Like I said, I started to figure out how to think about how to make the system itself more modern and less expensive and more responsive and all these other things. And I realized that the Brayton cycle had some real advantages that were actually giving it a pretty good market share in many applications. Brayton cycle turbines, of course, run every jet airplane in the world. Right. Brayton cycle machines run most turboprop engine turboprops, helicopters. If you look at the power plant market, almost every power plant built in the U.S. from about 1990 on was a Brayton cycle gas turbine. So there's a lot of advantages to the Brayton cycle. And I thought, the Brayton cycle is designed or is another heat engine that needs a steady heat source, just like the Rankine cycle does. And so at one point in my research, I sat down at an old library search computer and used, what people use today for research, the search technology, and typed in the words gas turbine and nuclear, and realized that I wasn't the first to think of this.
I've had that experience a few times.
But it was a eureka moment for me because, that means that, when you're not the first to think of it, that means maybe there's really something to it.
Yeah, that's a fair statement, I would say, right there. So go ahead.
Yeah, sometimes when you're the first to think of something, you realize quickly that there's a reason why nobody else thought of it.
I've been there and done that. Someday I'll tell you the story about my liquid cesium core reactor. Okay. that's a bad story, but anyway, yeah. I'm interested. So you're looking now for your cycle. You're looking for something with an inlet temperature of around you said 900 to 950 degrees C. Is that correct?
Right, and it can work as low as 800 C, but much lower than that, you start getting very low thermal efficiencies in a Brayton cycle.
Sure, and we need to be clear that high temperature versus low temperature, that is a measure of efficiency in most systems,
mm-hmm.
Carnot efficiency. So what we're going to what I'm interested about is what's the temperature at the other end of the turbine when you exit the turbine on the first pass there?
Okay, well, the exit of an Adams engine is about 600 down to maybe 500 degrees C exhaust temperature. So it's pretty high exhaust temperature, but unlike a lot of the folks in the close, and again, this is going to be a closed cycle gas turbine because the gas that runs through the reactor doesn't get changed as it goes through the reactor, unlike in an open cycle combustion turbine where the gas that goes to the turbine has a bunch of combustion products you got to get rid of. The gas that goes to the reactor stays the same.
So and your working fluid, as I understand, is going to be helium. Is that correct?
No. No, that's another piece of the Adams engine which is different from most others.
Okay.
Is the working fluid in the Adams engine is nitrogen.
Oh, okay.
Or possibly a mixture of some nitrogen with some oxygen. Probably not the same as the same mixture as what air would be. But
okay.
The idea there, using nitrogen, is that because air is 80% nitrogen, and the thermodynamic properties of nitrogen are very close to those of oxygen, a nitrogen turbine and an air-breathing turbine are essentially the same. There's no need to change the rotor design, the casing design, the bearing design, anything else like that to go from air to nitrogen. If you want to build a turbine for helium, everything changes.
I assume on the nuclear side as well, because helium is has certain effects on the moderation and so forth. So,
well, as it turns out, if you look at a pebble bed reactor,
mm-hmm.
and you realize that in a pebble bed reactor, a close-packed volume of spheres is going to be about 61% the sphere and 39% the gaps between the spheres. So in the reactor, only 39% of the volume will be filled with the gas.
Right.
And since gas is a much lower density than the fuel and graphite, and you run the numbers, you realize that on a mass basis, the gas has very little effect, either moderation or anything else. It essentially is like void space in the reactor, particularly when you operate with the gas in the reactor at a relatively low pressure. In the Adams engine, the reactor pressure is only about 6 to 7 times atmospheric pressure.
Oh, okay. So that's fairly low pressure.
Yeah. The pressure and temperatures in the cycle for an Adams engine are essentially the same as the pressures and temperature in a combustion gas turbine.
Okay.
So the maximum pressure would be somewhere, actually it could be as high as 10 times as much as atmospheric, but that's only 150 PSI.
Well, that's very interesting. So the moderation in this case is coming from the carbon and the treated fuel. Is that? Let me step back further. Is the reactor running on a thermal spectrum, or is it running on an epithermal spectrum, or what's the spectrum in the reactor core?
The initial cores will be running on a thermal spectrum. Roughly the moderator to metal ratio in the fuel, and that's the ratio of the graphite to the uranium or thorium or plutonium, whatever the fuel is about 200 to 10, so 20 to 1, which is pretty well fully moderated with a graphite moderated reactor. That said, there's nothing magic about that ratio. And there are some core designs that we've been playing with where we increase the amount of fuel and reduce the amount of moderation for various reasons.
All right, so that kind of brings me to my next question, which is more of an economic question. When you're talking about these fuels, these are fuels that will have to be manufactured, and presumably will have to be manufactured by someone that has the capability to manufacture large quantities of fuel, and they may, you know, what I'm asking is how does it compare to, say, the fuel that would be in one of the HTR reactors, like the one that's now operating in China, or the prismatic reactors, who would be manufacturing this fuel, and is it going to be readily available, do you think? Or?
Well, right now, that's the fuel manufacturing, the fuel supply, is one of our challenges, and our meaning Adams Atomic Engines. The HCR fuel used in the Chinese reactor would be fine, in, at least in terms of its general properties. Unfortunately, that fuel probably would not be able to be licensed in the U.S., for various reasons, mainly due to the control of the manufacturing process. The U.S. NRC wants to have very specific steps in the manufacturing process that can be verified so that they know that the fuel has the properties promised. But it may be that the Chinese fuel would eventually be able to be licensed.
China works very, very closely in other industries with U.S. regulatory authorities. I wouldn't imagine that it would be impossible.
No, it's not impossible. It's just one of those things where the U.S. NRC is a very conservative organization that is going to ask a lot of hard questions before they ever license fuel manufactured. As a matter of fact, they're going to ask hard questions for fuel manufacturing in the U.S. There's a couple of companies in the U.S. that have made high-temperature TRISO-type fuel before. One of them is General Atomics out in San Diego, and one is...
Sure, and that's the core of their technology.
Right, and one is BWXT, which is Babcock, and which used to be known as Babcock & Wilcox. BWXT has manufactured some of the test materials for some of the DOE's high-temperature reactor projects recently.
Okay. So you think that's a problem that you have, but it's one that's certainly surmountable in any case.
It's definitely surmountable. The problem that we have is that it's a chicken and egg kind of thing. We don't really want to be in the business of making the reactors and the fuel. We want to build, as I said, engines, because we think that our secondary system is far more economical and simple to operate than a steam plant.
That brings us to the next question, which is something about the mission of the Adams Atomic Engine, which, as I understand it, is to be a very economical system both to build and operate. How would the Adams Atomic Engine compare in terms of requirements for operators with a steam plant?
Well, steam plants have a lot more pieces to them, a lot more components that need to be inspected and monitored during operation. Gas turbines are very simple systems, often operated at least somewhat remotely. I mean, nobody actually goes and looks at a jet engine while they're operating. They just use gauges and everything and control it by wire because the jet engine's out on the wings and nobody walks out to look at it. The idea is that these engines would be fairly low number of people to monitor, simply because there's not much to monitor. There's only four major components. You've got a compressor, a reactor heater, a turbine, and a cooler. And of course, the turbine is connected to a generator. So if you want to count that as a separate component, then there's five components.
Well, from my perspective, one of the things that I like about high temperature reactors is the capability to use thermochemical cycles. And I guess one of the big things in power technology in recent years has been this so-called combined cycle technique from the dangerous fossil fuel industry.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things about that concept, aside from the use of fossil fuels, has been the ability to recover waste heat. And I guess if you're coming in at 600 degrees C out of the turbine, you could theoretically, at least, run a normal steam plant off the side on that. Or you could use that process heat for chemical purposes. Actually, it turns out that the prominent thermochemical cycles actually run at around over 850 degrees C. So I'm not sure, but there are certain portions of the process that certainly would be able to run at 600, and there are a few other thermochemical cycles. So have you thought about anything about adding on some process devices off the side that will recover some of that heat and therefore enhance the economics in any way? Or is that kind of down the road a little piece?
Well, we've thought about a lot of things that could be added to the cycle. What we want to focus on initially, though, is building a very simple, easy-to-operate plant without a whole lot of bells and whistles. Okay. We want to get the Model T out there before we start building the Cadillac or whatever.
And I think that's probably a good approach.
Yeah, we really think that part of the reason why some of the closed-cycle gas turbine ideas have not ever come to fruition is people kept adding things to them that increase the capital cost. There are certainly ways to make a Brayton cycle more thermodynamically efficient. We advocate a very simple cycle machine without any intercoolers, no stages of cooling within the compressor, and no recuperation of the waste heat on the exit. And we believe that there's a pretty good model for that. That's the way that the combustion gas turbines actually were introduced, is very simple cycles. And eventually, once the cycle got established, then people started saying, well, we've got this nice hot exhaust. How can we reuse that exhaust for something else?
Okay, well, that's probably a fair approach, certainly from a business side of the equation, because here you're getting in the door, you're getting the thing operating, and that's kind of helping you along to get your feet on the ground. Now, I've heard about these, and a few people have asked me about these so-called atomic batteries, these fast reactors that Toshiba's building. I think they're planning one for Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
How does that stack up competitively with the Adams atomic engine?
Well, the Toshiba 4S reactor, which is, I can't remember what the 4S's are, simple, secure, safe, something or else, is an interesting design. As you say, it's a reactor where the reactor is designed to last for 30 years without refueling. But it is also designed to be mounted in a vertical silo, which is requires a fair depth. I think it's something like 60 or 70 feet below grade to establish the thermal driving head for the sodium that will circulate through this reactor. And so it has liquid sodium circulating through with what's called a natural circulation, because you heat the stuff low, which causes it to rise. And then as it rises to a heat exchanger where the steam plant is, then, of course, what's cooled in the heat exchanger will naturally sink. So you have to have enough distance to have a thermal driving head. So that limits the applicability of the 4S for some of the markets that we're interested in, like ship propulsion. There's not a 60-foot separation available on a ship. You'd have problems with stability. That is one issue. And for us, the other thing is that, quite frankly, I have a hard time believing that anything that has a supercritical steam plant as the conversion mechanism from heat to electricity can be considered to be a battery.
Okay.
Steam plants are not, there's nothing complex about steam plants, but they are not simple machines to operate. They require trained operators. They require a certain amount of maintenance. Again, I'm not criticizing the 4S. I think it's a neat design, but it's certainly not a battery. Some salesman came up with that term, not an engineer.
Well, there's nothing wrong with salesmen. I mean,
well, there is nothing wrong with selling and with making sure that people understand the benefits of your product. But sometimes I think salesmen get the engineers in big trouble by overpromising and making it hard for the engineers to deliver.
I fully appreciate what you're saying. I've heard it as a marketing tour, and you know, in my position, I talk to a lot of people, as you know, who are anti-nuclear, and there's sort of this third set of people who are ambivalent. You know, they come up with these terms. We need a safer nuclear reactor, which is kind of hard to imagine because there are
pretty damn good safety record, yeah.
But so you know, people hear about here in terms of, I hear a lot about pebble beds, and I hear a lot about atomic batteries, and people ask me the questions about it. So I've heard of it as a battery. I'd also thought that reactor was a lead bismuth cooled reactor, but I could be wrong on that. I'm sure you're right, and I'm not. But let's talk a little bit about your market. You're marketing this for ships. What other kind of applications do you see? Do you see applications in small isolated areas, or do you see applications in existing grid-connected large areas, such as New Jersey, for instance, or Maryland?
Well, one of the things that the reason that we designed this is not because we think that there's anything specifically unsafe or wrong with the large pressurized water reactor, but we see that there's huge markets for combustion systems, fossil fuel systems, in much smaller sizes than 1,000 megawatts. You know, diesel engines and combustion gas turbines and stuff, there's hundreds to thousands of those sold every year, and many of them operating in places where a 1,000 megawatt reactor can't fit physically, and it certainly would be far more capacity than certain places can use. So we see applications on ships, certainly, on island nations, definitely, in developing countries where, you know, the whole grid may be a few hundred megawatts total, so you wouldn't want to have a 1,000 megawatt reactor in a grid that size. We see it in places where there are perhaps very valuable products, mining industries and stuff, located in remote areas. One of the customers or potential customers we've talked to knows of a beautiful supply of jade. It's almost a mountain of jade, he says, but it's in an area where there's no power to run any equipment and no way to get the jade to market. Of course, as you know, there's plenty of oil wells being drilled in deep ocean areas. Believe it or not, that's a big problem for the oil wells supplying power to those, because the oil, you know, offshore oil wells are powered by diesel engines or gas turbines that can't run on the product of the oil well. They have to ship the product of the oil well to a refinery and then ship it back to the offshore facility, which causes it to be pretty expensive out there. So those are all kinds of markets where we see something where there's a real demand for something in the 10 to 20 to 30 megawatt range.
Okay, so that's the size that you're targeting is around less than 100 megawatts?
Oh, far less. 10 megawatts is what we want for our first engines.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. So you're absolutely right. A lot of places, particularly in the third world or developing world, have an absolute need for that kind of that size reactor. And that's very interesting. Now, let's get to the question that everybody starts with. I think it's on some level a very silly question, but you always get asked it whenever you say the word nuclear. What about the waste? How are you looking to suppose we brought this reactor to a country like Cameroon? Cameroon is a country where basically they're chopping up the rainforest for fuel, mm-hmm. for wood, wood-burning fuel. And suppose I think it would be a great place to bring a small reactor that was flexible and fairly portable, and I assume your reactor is portable since it's going on ships.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose we brought it there. What would we do with the used fuel? Would we bring it back to the United States, or would we? How would we approach that question?
Well, our approach is to centrally manage our used fuel inventory by uh-huh. bringing it to a perhaps one, perhaps several locations around the world where we buy enough land and build a facility where we can nearly permanently for a long period of time store material, and eventually once we have a large enough inventory of the material where we can build a recycling operation.
Okay.
It doesn't make sense to build a recycling operation before you have enough inventory to process.
That's a very fair statement. And around the world, we are in fact accumulating. it's kind of strange when you think about that question, because to my mind, one of the problems with the used nuclear fuel, as you've gotten me to call it, is that historically there just hasn't been enough of it.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. There was a recycling facility in. Let's see, somewhere near Chicago, and when I think General Electric built it, and for the first, it operated for a while, but they couldn't get enough inventory of the used material to process, so it would never operate at an economical rate. They eventually shut it down. I think the same thing happened to the West Valley facility in New York.
Yeah, I would believe that. And of course, you have to add the cost of chemical processing, which is non-trivial. It's probably cheaper in the short term, not for the long term, but for the short term. If you only include the internal cost, it's definitely cheaper to use virgin uranium or even better thorium,
right?
For these purposes. But I know you're not really wedded so much to TRISO type fuel, but. For me, from my chemical perspective, and I think you and I may have talked about this offline in our last conversation, I was concerned that the problem with that fuel is that it's too stable. Not that it's. I personally believe that you could put if you addressed all the criticality concerns, you could probably put TRISO fuel in the field for 5,000 years and nothing would happen to it,
right?
Except for maybe a little bit of oxidation on the surface. But you'd said to me that in terms of that you really feel that this fuel is in fact recyclable by mechanical manipulation. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, and there's actually two things that we've been thinking about in terms of how you recycle or maybe just reuse the TRISO type fuels.
Okay.
One is, if you want to separate out the products, maybe keep all the heavy stuff in one place and the lighter fission products in another, the fuel particles can be ground up and separated through pure physical means. The density of plutonium and uranium is pretty significantly different than the density of all the fission products. So that's one of the things that we've been playing with and thinking about how to do that. And in some metals processing or mining industries, there's some pretty good examples of how you separate out heavy stuff from light stuff. Simply
through flotation as well.
Yeah, flotation and grinding and stuff. So that's one thing. The other thing that is possible is that as long as the TRISO coatings are intact, there's no reason to not just put the fuel or keep the fuel in a neutron flux and to continue the process of absorptions and fissions to the point where you use a much larger portion of the initial metal. Right now, TRISO particles, the state of the art is that they've been proven to use about 8%. We get about 80,000 megawatt days per ton of.
Okay, and just for reference for anyone that's unfamiliar, typical reactors now are running at about 30 to 40,000 megawatt days per ton. Is that correct?
Right. But the,
you're getting twice the efficiency.
Right. But the it's still only 8% of the initial metal. If you arrange the fuel properly and you keep the neutron flux supported through the use of things like maybe a seed and blanket design or something like that, you can encourage the uranium-238 to absorb a neutron and become plutonium-239, and then it will fission the next time it gets hit. So you can convert more and more of that initial metal into usable fuel and then into energy. So if we could get the TRISO particles to go to, say, 25 or 250,000 megawatt days per ton or 300,000 megawatt days per ton or even 500,000 megawatt days per ton, which is certainly...
Well, you guys are aggressive.
That's certainly within the realm because it's not that... There's nothing really to do other than make sure that the coatings don't break down.
Sure. But that brings up the question: What's the breeding ratio on the reactors as you're envisioning?
Now, see, that's one of the reasons why I talked about altering the moderator to fuel ratios.
Okay.
Some of these TRISO particles date back to a German design first done by a guy named Rudolf Schulten. And he built a reactor called the AVR, and AVR stands for a long German name that I can't pronounce, the last part of its reactor. But the AVR ran for about 25 years and tested a large variety of different types of fuels. And some of the fuels that they used, some of the ratios of metal and enrichment and moderator, got to a breeding ratio that was pretty close to one. I think the best I saw was 0.98.
That's pretty good.
So if you're getting to a point where you've got a 0.98 conversion ratio, that means every time you use up a fissile atom, 98% of the time you make another fissile atom. So as long as you've got a little bit of excess reactivity at the beginning, you can make that core last an awful long time before you run out of fissile isotopes. And
of course, if you have thorium in there, you're even a little bit ahead of the game.
Sure, sure. With thorium, you can get to one or even a little better than one. And one of the things that it's interesting as you read review history and stuff, you realize that a lot of the folks that talk about fast breeder reactors. You know, they talk about fast because that's the thermal spectrum, but there was also some desire at the very early stages of the nuclear era to make the breeding occur fast enough to refuel some reactors sooner rather than later. Because in the early days, people thought that uranium was a very rare material. We hadn't done much exploration for it. Before World War II, there was no real demand for uranium other than to color a few plates here and there. Or maybe to find some radium, which was a very valuable material. But, you know, there wasn't much demand, so there wasn't much in the way of exploration for it. So that's, you know, the idea of slow breeding or conversion is not something that's been terribly popular. But, you know, the U.S. had this interesting program called the Thermal Breeder Reactor, which was in the last core of the Shippingport reactor. They used a design by a guy named Alvin Radkowski.
He has the Thorium Power Company. He's descended from him.
Right. Of course, it's no longer Alvin's company since he's no longer with us.
No longer with us, right.
Yeah, it's actually the CEO of that company is a man named Seth Gray, who's been very active in the non-proliferation area as a lawyer. But anyway... Beyond that, the last core of the shipping port did a seed and blanket where they had a small amount of highly enriched fissile material in the center of the core, and it was surrounded by a lot of fuel rods with mostly thorium dioxide in them. and they achieved a breeding ratio a little bit better than one. And that reactor its operation was pretty interesting because they were operating it and kept wanting to shut it down to do the analysis. But the thing was, I mean, the reactivity wouldn't go away. It kept operating and producing lots of power. And eventually they said, you know, we got to shut this thing down so we can do the chemical analysis, even though it wasn't anywhere near the end of core life. I think it had been operating.
And that had light water in it, that reactor.
Yeah, it was the shipping port reactor. So it was still a pressurized light water reactor. And so what that indicates is even with a thermal spectrum with thorium, you can get breeding. You can get a conversion ratio greater than one, which if you design the reactor properly, just means the reactor operates for a very long time while it's converting the fuel and then using the fuel inside the same reactor without a physical separation process down the road.
Yeah, because in my perhaps naive interpretation, you have a problem with absorption into the light water, absorption of neutrons, because the cross-section for good old-fashioned standard hydrogen is somewhat higher.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that even with light water, they were able to achieve a breeding ratio of better than one? I hadn't understood that. I knew that they'd run the reactor on thorium, but I didn't really understand that the breeding ratio had actually been more than one on that reactor.
Yep. It was more than one, slightly. It was like 1.03 or something like that. But as you said, that was with water as a moderator. With a gas as a moderator, with a gas coolant and graphite as a moderator, pure graphite, it's possible to achieve an even slightly better breeding ratio because graphite has very little absorption compared to hydrogen.
Right.
So, you know, this is down the road, but I think that, you know, it's possible to design these reactors to run for, you know, long lifetimes, get lots of utilization out of the fuel, and not have a whole bunch of long-lived materials left over at the end. And again, to my mind, storing some amount of used fuel for a long time above ground in a place where there's some guards around it, and a place where people can take care of it. If they see any problems, they can fix them, is reasonable. And it's not, as some people portray it, as, you know, pushing a problem off to my children. It's providing future generations with a huge resource above ground, ready to use whenever they get around to it.
Well, you know, that's my shtick, you know. I'm more concerned, actually, recovering some of the what I regard to be very valuable fission products. Let me step back a little bit and say that it's not impossible, certainly, to chemically recycle TRISO fuels. You know, generally what's involved is fluorine chemistry, and people like to stay away from fluorine chemistry if they can, because chemically, I think the chemical issues are more serious maybe than the nuclear issues. So I've tended not to think so much about those reactors because I kind of came to an interest in nuclear power from another direction, which was really how to handle the various components of used nuclear fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to me, having something that's chemically and thermodynamically stable, like silicon carbide, was less than ideal because I always like to get at the fuels. And that's why I hope down the road a piece, since it's not an essential component, and I'm sure you and I will talk about this many times before, that you'll give these molten salt ideas some more thought.
Well, like I said, for the markets that we're looking at, the idea of not having to do anything to the fuel is attractive, and it helps answer some people's questions, even if the questions are in some cases illegitimate. But you know, we like to think of the reactor as a sealed unit, where the reactor itself would be replaced at whatever interval it needs to be replaced, probably on the order of a few years at a time, which is pretty cool. I mean, when you only have to bring in a 2 meter by 2 meter cylinder every, say, 3 to 5 years, as opposed to bringing in thousands to tens of thousands to millions of gallons worth of fuel, it's a pretty good deal for those remote areas.
Oh, yeah, and I think the environmental attractiveness is enormous, I mean, just on that side.
Yeah, clean enough to run inside a submarine.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that point is one of, and, you know, I started, when I first encountered nuclear issues on the internet, I encountered, in fact, you, and one of the first points that you made was that, you know, literally thousands of people have lived within a few meters of nuclear reactors for quite some time on ships, and I think people miss that point frequently.
Yeah.
But it's a good point to make. I'm a little bit more, you know, just from the technical side of my little bit nerdish side out of here. I'm curious to why you chose nitrogen. One of the great things about nitrogen, of course, is that it's not chemically reactive. It's almost inert, which has made the nitrogen industry so important. Going back to German times, but it has a fairly high cross section for absorbing neutrons, does it not? Nitrogen, is that any concern for you? Or?
Well, the percentage of nitrogen that will be converted in the reactor is very low. The cross section is not zero, but it's on the order of 2 or 3 barns. And of course, barns is a unit that nobody understands except real geeky people. But that's a fairly small number. When nitrogen gets activated or absorbs a neutron, it does get converted into a radioactive material. But the radioactive material is a very common one that has very little health effect. It's called carbon-14. It's also a material that's very simple to absorb and filter out of the coolant. It's easy to design a filter that absorbs carbon-14 from a stream of nitrogen. So the big reason that we like nitrogen as opposed to helium, which almost everybody else in the high-temperature gas reactor world looks at, is that nitrogen acts the same as air. So that whole body of combustion turbine and combustion compressors out there, air-breathing machines, that whole industry, all of the people that know about those machines, all of that infrastructure is applicable to what we want to do.
So you get everything off the shelf in that case.
It's essentially off-the-shelf components. And on the other hand, the people that want to do helium have to build their turbines and compressors specifically for helium. And there hasn't been a huge market for helium turbines. There's some helium compressors out there. Certainly there is a helium industry, but it's relatively small compared to the air breathing industry. And the other piece of it is, if you started to build a reasonable number of high temperature gas reactors using helium as the coolant, and you start running the numbers for how much helium will be required in inventory for each reactor. If you're a person like me who understands the law of supply and demand, you quickly will realize that the price of helium today and the price of helium in a few years of building high-temperature gas reactors will have little relationship to each other.
Well, that's a lot of people don't actually understand this, but helium is one of the least renewable things there are. In fact, when helium is released from a balloon,
it goes away.
Yeah, it boils off into space. It's why it's not found in the Earth's atmosphere. The what's called the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, which measures the speed of molecules, it turns out that a fair fraction of helium has escape velocity.
Mm-hmm.
So we cannot recover it from there. And whenever I think about these helium-cooled reactors, I always have that in the back of my mind. Of course, a great place to get helium is from the decay of actinides, but there's not enough actinides to make a significant amount of helium.
Well, actually, there are enough actinides to make a significant amount of helium. That's where we get the helium we find today, I think.
I mean transuranium actinides. Let me correct that. Yeah, that's right. All of the helium on Earth, in fact, arises from nuclear decay in the core of the Earth. But that resource, and there are only actually a few mines, a few natural gas wells in the world that produce helium. Kansas has been producing it, and I'm not sure that helium is going to be there for all that much longer. So there's a concern.
Yeah, there's a pretty good inventory of helium. I mean, at one time, helium was a strategic element, and the U.S. had most of the world's supply of helium and protected it very carefully, because this was in the age where the other alternative for airships was hydrogen, and the U.S. had figured out that if we had helium and the other guys used hydrogen, our airships would be more survivable than their airships.
Right.
And actually, that was the airship market was another reason why I looked around to try to find out if there was another alternative, because at the time that I was doing the initial research and the initial design work for the Adams engine, there was a pretty significant interest in building a lot of airships for radar monitoring of coastlines and that kind of stuff, because they can stay on station a long time. And, you know, that the idea of helium being a relatively limited resource is something that has always been important. Of course, nitrogen is essentially no limit at all. I mean, all of the atmosphere in the world is 80% nitrogen. So,
right.
If we run out of nitrogen, we've got serious other problems to worry about.
Well, if the atmosphere gets hot enough, not that anybody'd be around to watch, but if it got hot enough, it would boil off.
Well, like you said, it would. Would it's like the tree falling in the woods. Would it really affect us? I don't know.
Yeah, nobody would notice. Yeah,
and I
mean, actually, if you look at the planetary atmosphere, the reason that Mars has such a small atmosphere, low pressure atmosphere, is in fact that much of its atmosphere boiled off. The Martians, if there are any, started with the same kind of rock we did.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that's very interesting, because I mean, it really seems to me that you've thought through a lot of the economic issues that sort of float around out there, and I think economics is a very, very, very important side of the energy equation that people sort of wave their hands at, particularly if they haven't thought the issue through very carefully. And what do you see as the cost for power out of a Adams atomic engine, rough figure?
Well, we believe that we will be competitive any place where electricity costs more than about 6 cents per kilowatt hour.
Okay.
As long as the
bus park car.
Right. As long as the load for our engines, as long as they can run at least 50% of the time at full load. The less, you know, if there's a market where they need a lot of power for a short period of time, of course, our power gets pretty expensive. It has to run significantly and consistently to be competitive.
You have to run a what kind of average capacity factor?
50% or better.
50% or better.
Yeah.
Which is still lower than what standard pressurized reactors.
Well, again, if we're aiming for markets like remote power areas, you know, the people who live on islands are going to go to sleep at night. The power demand in a small grid won't be we won't be able to run our engines at 100% all the time if we want to supply the whole grid. And we do want to supply the whole grid. We do want to replace the generators that are burning fossil fuels in those grids.
So you're able to do some load following with this design.
Absolutely. One of the, as a matter of fact, the patent that we had, we actually allowed it to expire because we think if anybody wants it, they can use it too. But the patent we had was a method of controlling the load for the system so it can vary from 0 to 100% rather quickly and at reasonable efficiency throughout the range.
You don't have problems with things like xenon poisoning or lags or anything like that?
Well, there is. Of course, xenon is something that has to be considered with every power reactor, but having come from a reactor plant that always varied power on board a ship and always load followed, I know how to account for that.
Okay.
I mean, that...
You know, I mean, as you know, first of all, my nuclear engineering is self-taught. So.
Right. Well, and as you know, most people talk about nuclear plants as something that goes to 100% power and stays there, and if it shuts down, it has to wait for days to start back up again. I'm here to tell you that doesn't have to be the case. It's all a matter of design. And, of course, I'm not saying anything new. Anybody who recognizes that submarines have had single reactors powering them ever since the Nautilus went to sea on January 17, 1955, had a single reactor plant that powered it out the channel, out to sea, went fast, went slow, came back. So it had to follow.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, yeah, I can't say that I know everything. Certainly, I didn't know. I'm really enlightened a lot on the Adams atomic engine because it really seems to have addressed a lot of what might be called holes in the public imagination and maybe my imagination as well on how to handle these reactors. I think we're right now, we're about an hour's time. You want to cut off and maybe resume the conversation?
Sure.
On a later show?
Sure. This has been great fun, and I appreciate you asking the hard questions. I of course, as you might imagine, I kind of love talking about this stuff. It's it's fun for me, and unfortunately, you know, after 18 years of doing the design work, my wife and I don't talk about it very much anymore.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm as you know, we haven't known each other very, very long, but I think first of all, why I ask the hard questions because everybody asks me the hard questions. You have to remember that I travel in the anti-nuclear circle, so. I have a lot of harder work to do, maybe. I think I've managed to convince people because really the basic advantages of nuclear energy or atomic energy, as you call it, are just so, undeniable, for lack of any better term, but people do have a certain sort of mindset, and I've thought about questions like load following, and I've thought about the success of the pressurized water reactor. But as you know from my writings, getting power and energy to some of these remoter places is very important to me. I think it's a very important human issue that we all face. And certainly, I'm really interested to talk a little bit further about it. Okay?
Thanks again, and I hope you all enjoyed the show.
Hi, everybody. This is Wayne Termel asking you to join me for the Working Week. not the whole week, because neither of us has that much time, but for the Working Week podcast. That's the weekly digest of research, news, and opinion from the pages of managementissues.com. And that's the world's leading site for business, management, and human resources. My guests and I will talk about the news that matters to those of us just trying to survive the working week. That's workingweek.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.